Hello and welcome to the Dentist Magazine podcast. I'm Eddie McKenzie, editor of The Dentist, and here to present the first in a new series of conversations. To kick off, we're featuring a discussion with Simon Gambold, founder of Engage the Team, and we're talking all about the subject of leadership. But before that, someone who knows all about good leadership, she experiences it every day at work, is my assistant, Ellen Cummings. She's here to tell you about some of the webinars coming up from our sister publication, Dental Update.
Thanks, Eddie. The Dental Update webinar series is continuing throughout this month. On the 6th of April, we have specialist periodontist Jun Seung talking about the management of dentine hypersensitivity in clinical practice. On the 8th of April, there's MJ Roland Warman discussing how you can grow your aesthetics practice without spending a penny on marketing. On the 14th of April, Saoirse O'Toole will be explaining the relationship between dentine hypersensitivity and erosive tooth wear. And finally, on the 15th of April, dentist Ben Atkins and dental hygienist Anna Middleton will be providing inspiration on how to make social media work for you and your practice. The webinars are free and are available both live and on demand. To register, visit webinars.dental-update.co.uk.
Thanks for that, Ellen. That's brilliant. That's what's coming up in the next few weeks, but for now, here we are in conversation with Simon Gambold discussing leadership. Simon, you've throughout your career you've been involved in a number of leadership roles, haven't you?
Yes, I mean my background is sales, marketing, and business management, and over four decades I've run organizations from direct marketing businesses right up to larger full service businesses. And I joined the dental industry about just over 25 years ago with Henry Schein to head up one of their direct marketing businesses. Moved into a leadership role eventually running the UK businesses, dental and medical businesses, and then finally moved into a European role as part of the European leadership team responsible for the 13 markets in Europe. So I found that having started in marketing and having loved marketing, I was moved more into team leadership roles and actually found my love for building and leading teams. So when I left Henry Schein 2 years ago, I decided to focus on working with dental teams and talking about leadership.
Do you think people understand what leadership actually is though? Because I think it's perhaps one of the most misused terms we have. When if a political leader U-turns on a policy, his supporters or her supporters will say that's good leadership because they're listening to the people who disagree with them, and then the people on the other side will say that's bad leadership because they're not being decisive. People use the term to mean vastly different things, and I guess it would help if we established at the first, when we're talking about leadership, what exactly do you mean by leadership? What do you think makes good leadership?
Yeah, that's a very good starting point, and you're right, there are lots of different versions and misconceptions about what leadership is, and many people believe that you are either born a leader or you're not, and that's one of the first misconceptions I deal with in my training, is that anyone, if they are suitably motivated, can train and become a leader through practice and reflection and practice. You don't need to be born to it. But yes, I mean, for me, leadership is about it's the art of influencing people in a particular direction. So you're taking people down a road, and on a human personal level, you're helping people be more successful than they believe they can be. And that's the fundamental gift of leadership in my mind, helping not myself but other people be more successful, but not only that, more successful than they think they can be. And that's really the powerful aspect and the fun aspect of leadership.
So that's the definition, if you like, but putting that into practice, does the method of how you practice good leadership have to depend then on the people you're dealing with and the environment that you're working in? Does it depend on the personality types of the people that you're involved with?
That has a big impact. There are 101 different theories about leadership. So one of the things I recognised quite early on, I mean, having been on a Harvard Ambitious Leadership Programme with Henry Schein, having had myself trained and certified as a coach, a lot of leadership training is designed for full-time professional leaders. You know, when I was running the Henry Shine's UK business, yes, I had 600 plus people at 13 locations, but all I had to do was run that team. that's the only thing I had to do. So if you're in a dental practice or any other profession like that, you are the production engine of your business. So doing the clinical dentistry is a full-time job. Then you have to fit leadership around that. And most practices, in my experience, spend about half a day a week. Most dental principals spend about half a day a week on the business rather than in the business. So I wanted to design a leadership program that was tailored to 3 hours a week. You know, what can you achieve if you put aside 3 hours a week and make real progress? So I've come up with a toolkit of basic skills you practice, and practice makes perfect. And you, to master something, you have to consistently practice it. And that's what I help practice principals do. And they create their own authentic version of leadership. So it does vary depending on the person, most significantly, but also the people around them. But the most 90% of it is about them and what's special to them and how they want to lead.
So just going back to your time at Henry Schein, when you said you were in charge of a huge team, a multinational organization, now you are founder of it, Engage the Team. Is there a different level of stress or pressure that you put on yourself when you're only managing yourself? Or is it the case that do you have to still apply the same principles even though it is only a team of one?
That's an interesting question. I mean, the pressures are very different.
Yeah.
And the stresses are very different. But the core principles I learn over my three decades, certainly two decades as a senior leader, I apply now. And those principles are the same. So whether you're dealing, I mean, we had over 3,500 team members in Europe. And whether I was dealing with them or I'm dealing just with myself and a principal, his or her team that I'm coaching, I use the same principles. And I find that is the most important thing. They're true, whatever the dynamics of the organization. I can be talking to a dental hospital or a tiny dental practice or a big corporate group. The same principles apply.
Yeah. You said earlier on that one of the biggest myths is that you're either born with it or you're not. There are obviously, even though you say everyone can be a leader, there are obviously certain personality types that are better suited perhaps to being a leader, would you say? Or is that in itself a myth?
I think that's a myth. I think the key thing is, are you motivated to lead? Do you want to be a leader, and why do you want to be a leader? One of the things I noticed after I was reviewing my first year is running Engage the Team and the clients I'd worked with, and I was talking to some colleagues about the experience, and I realized what they all my clients had one thing in common, because they're from different backgrounds, different genders, different ages and races, and they had one thing in common. They knew there was something they didn't know, and they were open to learning. And I've also know a bunch of dentists have been my friends for years and years who, let's say they're not open to that. And a couple have said to me, will you work with me? And I've gently said no, because I know that they're not open to new ideas and the different ways of working. Evidenced by the fact they'll tell me what leadership is. But the people I work with are open to that. So I think anybody who is open to development, I mean, you need to have a personal development plan for your leadership skills as yeah. well as your clinical skills, I think, if you're a practice owner. Anyone who's open to that can take the basic steps and practice them and use them, and they'll be effective.
Yeah.
You know, asking open-ended questions and listening to what people say.
Yeah.
Ask an open-ended question and shut up and listen. That is the number one technique to turn you into a leader, and you practice it and you practice it and you practice it. And that anyone can do that if they want to. Now, some people know the answer, they don't want to do that, and they'll go, I mean, you go to the armed forces, you will find lots of people say, go over there, do that, in fact, do it in this way, and don't, you know, that's it. And there are people who want to do that. And that's leadership, and that's a different type of leadership, but I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in people who want to be engaged and involved and have their ideas explored and take responsibility and ownership and go out and achieve. And it's much more rewarding.
I think it's interesting you say that I guess one level of management, I guess, or one attitude towards management is you get the people to do what you want them to do. In terms of asking a question and listening to the answers. I know from personal experience, some people will deliberately ask a question in a certain way to try and get the answer that they want to hear rather than actually be open to new ideas. It's
leading the witness.
It's very, very tempting to do that when it's possible to do that. It's a real temptation to just, I guess, pull rank sometimes and just say, no, this is it. This is the way we want to do it.
Well, there are different leadership styles, and when I do my full day program, I'll talk about the six different leadership styles. So, you know, there are situations like in an emergency where you need to tell people what to do. You know, leave the building now, by the fire exits. It's not going to debate what should we do. We don't want to ask the people for ideas. We tell them what to do. So there are situations where you would use different styles of leadership. But broadly, you know, my philosophy is around engaging people. So you want their ideas and input. So you need to be open to their ideas. And everybody does things differently. And one of the key challenges for us, particularly people who run businesses, and particularly people who are very detail-oriented, and to take someone like that and ask them to stand back and let the rest of their team do it their way is very challenging.
Yeah.
And part of the practice we do is, in meetings, is ask people for ideas and train ourselves to go, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
Not, oh, no, hang on, I tried that before. Oh, no, we did that before. That won't work because. Oh, do it differently. Oh, no. And training yourself to go, great idea. Now, unless it's a completely bonkers idea, and it's going to break the business or harm patients, clearly you don't allow that. But if it isn't that, just say yes. It doesn't matter. People are going to do it differently to you. That's okay. The important thing is to get them motivated, engaged. They will then take that off and go and do it.
Yeah.
You can keep your focus on the important stuff to you, the clinical stuff, the next treatment plan you're working on. And you, what you're doing is you're opening this capacity, this productivity in the practice. Creating a motivated, engaged team who delight the patients, who enjoy their work, and freeing you up to focus more on the stuff that generates the real revenues, you know, and delights you as an individual clinician.
I guess a lot of it then is relationship management. It's interesting you use the example of turning down some clients because you knew potential clients because you knew they wouldn't be open. I guess there's an analogy there within the practice as well to making sure that either the practice manager or the principal manages the relationship with their team to make sure that they are open themselves and respecting of the roles.
Yes, yeah, that's right. And there needs to be a will. There needs to be, you know, you need to, if you're pushing against the door to create change, there needs to be some weakness in the door. There needs to be enthusiasm to push that door. Otherwise, it won't open. And some of my clients, they listen to the strategy, the toolkit steps, and they agree with them and they like them, but we never get to them. We always deal with the issue in front of them that week. So the weekly or fortnightly call, the HR issue today, how do I deal with that? And we spend most of our time on that, and they never step back to plan ahead. But that, I think that comes with time. You need to deal with the fire in front of you before you can, in some degree, before you can focus on the long-term plan. But the one of the most amazing things about the COVID is that it gives us the what is called in business the burning platform. If you want to create change in an organisation, you need, as a leader, you need to create a burning platform, a reason why if we don't change, we're all going to die. And COVID provides a very good excuse for practice owners to say, we have to change.
Yeah. Well, this is speaking to some dentists who are now, for the first time, thinking, they're questioning whether they want to be in the NHS or not, or want to practice privately. And it's because they've not even considered it before, because they've just been doing what they've always been doing. And suddenly, as you say, there's a burning platform and they have to actually question it for the first time.
Yeah. And there are a number of things coming together because of COVID. You've got the reduced productivity in the practice because you're seeing fewer patients for longer and the fallow time.
Yeah.
You've got, apparently, you know, teams that were working together really well have come back from lockdown and they're struggling with mental health issues, childcare issues. So there's where there was a good function amongst the team, there may not be now.
Yeah.
And then you've got the patient, you know, the new digitized patient's journey. And there are lots of reasons and opportunities for the principal to say, actually, change. We need to change. We need to do things differently. So it's a fantastic opportunity to do that. And, you know, a lot of practices have gone from comfortably in the black to being break even. There's a structural change in the market brought about by COVID. You know, the goalposts have moved. So what worked for 30 years of your career or 20 years of your career is not going to work in the future. And that forces a change. Any transition or change is an opportunity to revisit how you do things and revisit your leadership.
I guess it is just, it's an attitudinal thing, isn't it? That some people, when they see every challenge as an opportunity, and other people will see any change as a bad thing. Change is bad was a motto in my office for a little while, actually.
It's human nature, Eddie. And,
yeah.
You know, this is one of the hallmarks of good leadership is consistent, clear and regular communication. Because people and human nature is to be nervous of change. So unless you are very, very clear with people about what change means, and given that we can't predict the future, that's not easy, people will step into that void and they'll come up with their own worst case scenarios. And, you know, we have to continually communicate with our teams, and we think we're repeating ourselves, but from where they're sitting, they're not. And I remember going around talking to my team. I committed to speak to my team in the UK 4 times a year at every location. So I wanted to eyeball 650 people 4 times a year at 13 locations. And you, the second or third time you speak to them, you see the penny drop. Third time you say something, they hear it, because there's so much going on.
Yeah.
People are so busy. There's so many people talking to them. And you really got to repeat and repeat and repeat things. And if you don't, they will, human nature, we will step in and make up the worst case scenario and worry about it. And particularly during COVID, this is why, you know, Zooming or talking to your team members on almost daily basis, certainly weekly, if not daily basis, to reassure them. And you're not going to promise them a future you can't deliver, but it's just about reassuring people and making sure they understand you're there to support them and hearing what their concerns are. It makes all the difference.
And this just in specific reference to COVID with that, a lot of things like that, just the odd conversation here or there over a coffee or something that would be a normal part of everyday practice for a lot of practitioners, talking to the nurse, something like this. Again, it's being conscious of the things that are important, because so much of the interaction within a team is not on a conscious level, is it? You just, after a while, you become friends and you don't consciously think, right, I need to do this as part of my role now.
That's exactly right. So we don't know what's missing when we go virtual. But we need to be conscious, and that's where, as leaders, we need to be conscious about what we're doing. Unfortunately, it's not about being someone's friend and talking to them when we feel like it. We need to make sure we're creating those moments for what I used to call the coffee machine moments for a chat. And you have to create those moments. And the way to grow and develop as leaders is reflection.
Yeah.
How did that last conversation go? How could I have done it better? What went well? What could I have done better? So I encourage my clients to, you know, put aside 15, 20 minutes every week at least. I used to do Monday and Friday, start at the end of the week. How did the conversations go? What was good? What didn't go so well? What should I do next time? So you've consciously got to practice and consciously make those connections. Otherwise, you will not be able to perform as a leader. I'm afraid that is the reality. And I would diary myself in those days. It was a BlackBerry, but I'd put in my BlackBerry everything I had to do, and it would pop up and remind me, talk to so-and-so, mention this, ask about that. How did this go?
Yeah.
Otherwise, you just won't be consistent as a leader.
Yeah. When you mentioned their reflection, it takes me back to watching The Office for the first time and seeing seeing David Brent, and an example, obviously a caricatured example of someone who has absolutely zero self-reflection, but it, fundamental to that character was the fact that he was officially the boss, but he perhaps didn't have the skill set to do it, and he was more concerned with being popular than he was actually doing a good job.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, and it's not such an extreme example, having worked through the 80s and 90s, you know, it's not that extreme, but that's what companies used to do. They wouldn't train people effectively, you know, they wouldn't select them correctly. If you were good at your job, you'd get promoted to the next level, which is totally not the right thing.
It's the Peter principle, isn't it? That you get, what's the quote? You get promoted to your level of incompetence.
Yes. Yeah. Having the right people trained in the right way. And I think, you know, there's no reason why he couldn't do that job if he was motivated to with the right training and guidance. He definitely could.
Yeah.
You know, he hadn't been given it. It's not his fault. It's the organisation's fault.
Yeah. Just on that, though, about people being promoted because they did one job well, so they've been promoted or given an extra responsibility. Within dentistry, you see this, within a practice, you see this happen when, I mean, now less so perhaps because practice management is becoming a more professionalised role, but quite often when I used to visit practices, the practice manager would just be the receptionist who happened to have been there the longest. There didn't seem to be any true reason to why they were promoted. They were just, okay, yeah, you did that, okay, so you get this next responsibility. And quite often you wonder if they were cut out for the responsibility they've been given.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, I mean, you want to develop people and give them additional responsibilities, but at the same time you've got to evaluate, have they got the competence, have they got the motivation, and am I going to give them the training? One of the first things I do with clients is we talk about their goals and their objectives and what kind of person they are, what kind of dentist they want to be. Are they clinically led or business led? Because that will determine the focus of the team they build around them. Most are clinically led. Some exceptional ones are business-led, but they still do both. But it's about their support. So a clinically led dentist, which is most cases, will need a really good business partner. So I call it a business manager, not a practice manager. And we end up trying to recruit the right kind of calibre of practice manager who could grow into that role and be a real business support to the principal.
Yeah. And I suppose it isn't just about getting the right people in, but also once they are in, actually respecting their roles too. I do think it's sometimes a little bit strange in dentistry when a principal will employ a business manager and then end up ignoring them because they're the owner and they can do what they want. It can be a strange dynamic, that, can't it?
But that's the nature of all organisations. If you're leading an organisation, you bring in experts in areas to advise you, but at the end of the day, it's your decision. And there may be valid reasons why you don't go with the advice of the expert, but you have the expert there to advise you so you can make the right commercial decisions. But those decisions are based on a whole bunch of factors. So I don't see any problem at all with having a very competent business manager who would go on certain issues, strategic issues, to the principal, and the principal decides. And that business manager has to understand who the boss is. You know, and the people who report into the business manager needs to understand. And a lot of practices I work with, that's never been, lines of authority, responsibilities have never been defined. And so you'll go to a meeting and someone will talk about, oh, we're going to put up the prices for hygiene. No, I don't agree with that. We're not doing that. It's like, excuse me, you're on the reception. You know, it's not up to you. But if that receptionist isn't on board, they'll be telling the patients that, oh, you put the prices are too high, you know, it's shocking. Go down the road to the other practice, you know.
Yeah, you really do need the whole team on board for things like that, because again, that's another thing that sometimes isn't fully understood about a practice. The relationship we sometimes think is just with the clinician, but it's not. It's with the nurse as well, or it's with the reception team when they're nervous, sat in the waiting room 5 minutes before they go in. That might be the most important time in the entire appointment.
It could be, and this, you know, this brings me on to one of the key things I've learned in my career, is that the most important stakeholder in any business is not the customer. So there's five stakeholders in a business. There's customers, suppliers, investors, the local community, and the team. And, you know, I learned at university that it's all about the customer, and the customer's king. Now, yes, the customer's important, but at the end of the day, the team is the most important stakeholder in my experience.
Yeah.
If the team aren't on board, it doesn't matter how good your chairside relationship is with the patient. If they go out to the front desk and the receptionist isn't on board, if the team is on board, they will take care of the patients. They will create an outstanding experience. So what you want is when the patient leaves the practice or puts the phone down, you want them to think, wow, that was good. I'll recommend my family and friends, which is what the key driver of revenue. And you can create that if you focus on the team. So a lot of what I do is helping dentists take this amazing empathy that they have with their patients. And their patients love them. I mean, they have fantastic rapport with their patients. And putting some of that onto their team. So instead of seeing their team as an obstacle between them and the patients, they start to engage the team and they become an enabler, and more patients come and love to practice more. And when you see that light bulb moment go on, it's fantastic, it really is. And they can, the dentist will start enjoying the non-clinical stuff, rather than thinking, it's my admin afternoon or my admin day. They'll start to think, oh, actually, this is good. I've got a couple of good meetings and I want to talk to, so-and-so about this, that, and the other.
You said in some practices that some of the roles aren't clearly defined. Is that something that you always, do you think that that's important? Do you always try and push people to, or practices to be clearer about who's responsible for what? Because sometimes when we think of leadership, we think of the leader at the top, but of course there's levels of leadership. So if you get the decon lead, she should have a clearly defined role that people respect. Or do you think that actually that can be navigated in an informal way?
No, I think that most practices don't define it clearly enough. And you don't need to go over the top and write, 20-page job descriptions and have monthly reviews, but you do need to define things in a way. People need a clear frame, a box within which they can operate, and they need to understand who to go to in this situation and what happens.
Yeah.
But you touched on a very important point there, which is everybody can be a leader. The nurse who's got responsibility for decon in the practice leads on that topic. And if they really pick that up, and you give, for example, I recommend that the team meetings, each person gets to speak about their area. And if that works, that person has leadership over the whole practice when it comes to decon issues. And that's fantastic for their self-awareness and for their fulfillment, if you like. And it's great for them for the rest of the practice. And they'll take responsibility for making sure that the decon is done appropriately. But the leader's got to make sure that person is competent and is suitably trained and motivated. Get them the resources, and take away obstacles, but primarily give them permission. What's the issue? What do you think we should do about it? What do you need to get it done? Great, when can you get it done by? And review it. Oh, it's going to take 2 weeks. Shall we catch up next Monday and you can let me know how it's going? Because you want to make sure it's on track and not going off in the wrong direction. So you gently keep track of things, but you give the person more and more freedom within that box you've established. And without those clear lines and without clear key performance indicators and measurements, you can't do that. But if you do that, the productivity of the team will shoot up and it will free the principal up to do the stuff they want to focus on.
It's interesting, actually. We've been running a competition for the last four or five years, an infection prevention and control competition that we've been doing. So I've gone around the country visiting practices and having them take us through a decon cycle and things like that. And it's really interesting to see it from not from a decon point of view, but from the way the practice operates. Because in some of the practices, the principal happily delegates and lets the decon lead get on with it and take charge. And in others, they get involved. And I haven't said it to them. Sometimes I think you should let this person do it because they know what they're doing, and you're actually putting them off, or you're doing more harm than good by putting yourself in there. But I guess delegation is a real, real sticking point for a lot of people.
It is. And that's a very big challenge. Detail oriented people want to make sure that everything is done correctly. And in reality, that often means everything is done the way they would do it. But the key thing there is reflection. You see, if you reflect on how things went, it gives you the opportunity to say, well, how could I have done it differently? Could it have been more effective? And what we will do, and you can record meetings, but you don't have to do that. But if you record meetings or look back on how things went, and I've done this, I find I haven't waited for the person to finish. I've jumped in with what I think is the answer.
Yeah.
Because I've got 2,000 things to do. I know what the answer is. I just want to get to it. And that person's getting there slowly, and you jump in with the answer.
Yeah.
Now, their ownership and motivation now is much less than if you'd let them get there and then said, great, great idea. What do you need to get that done? Could you pick that up for us? And that person is like, oh, wow. Yes, but we jump in. So if you reflect on the conversation and then gradually practice that delegation, and that one of the keys to my success, I think, in my career is delegation. And it partly happened by accident because I didn't know what the answer was. And I think it helped me. I surrounded myself with some very capable people and let them do what they were good at. And that worked well for the organisation. And you're always part of a team. So it worked well for me. And by default, I ended up delegating a lot.
Yeah. Well, I think some people, when they think of leadership, they think that they do have to do everything or be involved in everything. And of course, if you've got the right people there, all you have to do is make sure that they're happy and doing their jobs. You don't need to get involved in the minutiae of the...
You don't. I remember one of the things that the professor at Harvard said to us when we were on that course there was... If we were in big organisations, to be fair, but he said, as a leader, there are 1,000 decisions made in your organisation every day, 1,000 key decisions, and you're in the room for about 3% of them. So you better make damn sure that the other 97%, the team know what they're doing, okay? Because you're not in the room. And it's like, wow, yes. Now, the numbers are different, but in a practice, that is still true. Even in a small, single dental practice, a lot of decisions are being made, and the principal cannot make all of them all the time. And certainly they can't grow the business that way. So they need to make sure that the team around them are equipped to do that and know when to come to them and say, oh, I think this is happening. I think we should do that. Are you okay with that? Or what do you think I should do with this? And then they've got a chance to guide it.
What's your advice when you visit a practice or speak with a team and there's a character in there that is perhaps not the most enthusiastic? There's the not my jobber, if you like, that they're 5 o'clock, they will, that's it, I'm gone. They're not willing to stay an extra 5 minutes for this or that. There, it's nice to think that when given responsibility, people respond in a positive way. And there are some people who, well, they will only do what they're contracted to do and they won't be part of the bigger vision. They're not interested in that. They just want to do the hours, get their money, and that's it.
Yes, well, it's interesting. I one of the things I teach is my philosophy of any business has three types of... I use a picture of a bike cycling along with 10 people cycling along one of these fun bikes you've seen, you know, where you get a whole team of people on. But there are three types of people. There's the row at the front who are evangelical about the business. They're advocates. They love it. They're pedaling hard. They're helping to steer. They're cheering. And then there's a row at the back who aren't on board. They're not pedaling. They've probably got their hands on the brakes. They're making cynical, pessimistic comments and infecting the people around them. And then there's the 80-90% of people in the middle who are pedaling, but not that hard, but they're pedaling and they're coming to work to earn a living to live.
Yeah.
So as a leader, we should leave the group at the front alone because they're brilliant. Our first focus is the group at the back, and then once we've dealt with them, we then focus on the middle group to get them to pedal a bit harder. They don't all have to be advocates, but all you have to do is get them to work a little bit harder. And I'll come back to them. Your first focus is the group at the back and the demotivated people. First of all, they might be in the wrong seat. You've heard the expression, get the right people on the bus. You know, they might be the right people in the wrong seat. And sometimes, if I've done that before, I've moved someone and they've lit up.
Yeah.
They've performed. Generally, though, they are half glass empty people. And unfortunately, I've tried this. You focus on them and focus on them. And the minute you turn your gaze away, which you have to because you're running a business, they go back, they revert to type. So you need to get them off the bus, basically. Now, the bulk of people in the centre who may not be motivated, this is where you need to have some visionary leadership. You need to set out a vision for what the future could be like. If we all work together on this, what could we be part of in 3 to 5 years' time? So we come up with a vision for the practice, where it wants to be. And it's exciting. And the team, more and more of those people in the centre get excited and enthused, and they work longer hours and put more ideas in and get involved in extracurricular activities at the weekend, things like that. And so those people start to be engaged. And the more you have open, honest conversations with them and ask them for their ideas, the more they'll take responsibility and become engaged. And that's a natural process that happens with most people. Now, there are some people who just want to come to work, and you need people to move bits of paper from here to here, to use that old analogy, and they're fine. They're competent, solid people. They can't, you know, and that's fine. But for most people, you can engage them and involve them by asking for their ideas and letting them implement their ideas.
Yeah. As you said at the start, I guess it's understanding people and understanding what their motivations are. And sometimes I think people assume that everyone's motivation is money. And for a lot of people, they'll be perfectly happy with just being considered in certain ways. And actually, you don't necessarily have to throw a lot of money. It's not necessarily the most important thing in their life that's going to motivate them.
So it's the least important, usually. I mean, most... I said to a client of mine recently, he said, one of my team wants a pay rise. And I said to him, you know what that is, don't you? He said, what's that? I said, it's a cry for help.
Yeah.
Okay, people, that person's put their hand up and said, I want a pay rise. So that's asking for a conversation, and it's a cry for help, and it manifests itself in, I want a pay rise. But generally, it's about something else.
Yeah.
They're not engaged enough, they're not involved, they're bored, or whatever it is. Everybody needs purpose. And you can get very, I believe in organisations having higher purposes, but even if you don't want to go down that road, you still need to feel that what you're contributing to something that is of value. The two key determinants, research has shown, of engagement are feeling part of a team that's of value and having a leader that you trust. Okay, so if you can provide people with a mission or a vision that they can believe in and feel part of, and they can, the thing they do contributes to that result. Then people need to see, this bit of paper I'm moving, how does this contribute to our goal of being the best private practice in the town? How does that contribute? Okay. And secondly, do they trust you? And the best way to get to win people trust is to be open and honest with them. Listen to them, tell them stories, admit you make mistakes, don't jump on them from a great height when they get things wrong, and people will open up and trust you. You're only as good as your last behaviour. It's what you do, not what you say, of course. So you've got to walk the talk. But assuming you do that, you know, people will give you enormous leeway if you make mistakes and put your hand up.
Just to pick up on the point you said there about you're only as good as your last interaction or engagement. I think you see this sometimes with football managers, where they're a great success at one team and then they move somewhere else and it doesn't quite happen for them. And a lot of them struggle with that because they think, I'm doing the same thing that I've always done. I don't know why it's not as successful. And of course, that's the problem, isn't it?
The clue's in that, yeah. Well, you have to keep changing, which those changes will be wrong. Some of them will be wrong. So I remember saying to people that just because we're changing doesn't mean what we did before was wrong. What we did before was right for then, but now is different and we need to change, and some of the changes will be wrong, and that's okay, and we'll change again. And creating that culture is really important.
And of course, on a slight flip side to that, you can sometimes be successful in spite of bad leadership.
I mean, are they bad leaders if they're successful? Depends what you define success as. You've got to start by defining what success looks like.
True. Well, let's phrase it the other way then. There are lots of practices that make money but aren't necessarily well led. This is the CQC, in one of their key lines of inquiry, they ask, is a practice well led, don't they? When first hearing that, I thought that's a strange thing for the CQC to be involved in.
No, I think good leadership is an area that they should well cover, but they've got to define what it is then. You've got to set the parameters so people can see, you know. So we're nowhere near ready for doing that at the moment. But no, good leadership, there are 101 factors, not so much good leadership, success of an organisation, there are 101 factors for that. Good leadership is only one of them. And the way I look at it is, you know, if you talk about those bicycles cycling down the street, they're all dental practices. There are 50 dental practices cycling down the street, all performing at a similar level. If you can improve your leadership skills slightly, your practice will go slightly faster. And that's all we've got to do. You just need to improve your performance gradually each year by 1 or 2%, and you'll beat the competition. You'll win more patients. And so that's where these skills come in. All other factors will make a difference. Of course they will. But over a group, over an average, you just need to be able to move up the average slightly. And that's what you can do with these skill sets.
Yeah. So it's skill sets and attitudes then that make a good leader. The good thing on that side of things is that, as we said at the start, anybody can do that anybody can improve that if they work at it. Just in terms of that then, when you go and visit practices, what's the most common mistake you see principals make then when it comes to leading their teams?
The most common thing. I mean, what we spend our time doing is the HR issues that are right in front of the principal each day. this team member doing this, this team member wanting that, this team member not doing this. But the issue from a leadership standpoint is helping that principal understand where they want to go from in terms of their personal goals and their goals for the practice. So we take them through a process of understanding what they want from their life, what their goals are, how much time they want to spend in the practice. You know, we do a pie of their average day, number of hours sleep they need, number of hours they want to be in the practice, number of hours they want to be with their family. And then within the practice, how much is clinical and how much is non-clinical. So we come up with goals for them and then we come up with goals for the practice. And getting them to focus on that is very challenging because they keep getting understandably diverted by the fires in front of them. The urgent overrules the important. And that's natural in a business, and it takes an enormous amount of discipline to be able to handle those fires, because you can't ignore them, but to keep focus on the strategic, important, long-term things. And one of the things I say to people is, this job you're about to do, is this contributing to the goal we set? Is it going to take you towards that goal? Because if it isn't, why are you doing it? You need a really good reason. Now, there may be a really good reason, like someone's just resigned and they're going to walk out. But, you know, quite often there isn't. Either it's something you want to do, or it's been put in front of you as urgent. Why are you doing it? So is what you're doing taking you towards the goals that we've set? And if you haven't set those goals, how do you go forward?
It's good to hear you say, actually, that one of the first things is what are their life goals outside of the practice before you even start talking about what fixing the business. You've got to be clear what they want from their life, because I think sometimes people, when they're in business, they assume what will bring them happiness is the business turning a bigger profit or the business success. But actually, sometimes people really want more time at home, or they want to have a different work-life balance. And sometimes people don't even consider the question of the work-life balance, and that in itself is an issue for burnout and stress and things, isn't it?
Yeah, that you use a term I hate, which is work-life balance. It's homework. So you've got the element where you're in the at work, and you've got the element where you're at home. If you say work-life, it implies that your life isn't your work. And a lot of people live like that. They go to work so they can have their life outside of work. And a key for me on engagement is, if you can make work part of your life, you'll bring some of that motivation. So I'll give you an example. I discovered, if you talk to your team members and you discover some of the hobbies they have, it's amazing. Some of the things people do in their hobbies. And if you can take a fraction of that enthusiasm and engagement and bring it into the workplace, it's amazing. Absolutely amazing. So I think thinking about your work as part and your home as all part of your life, I think is a lot more empowering, and you can bring some of that enthusiasm and engagement to the workplace. If you can do that, that's great leadership.
Well, I think that's the perfect note to end on there. On great leadership. So, Simon, it's been great talking with you. Thanks for joining me today on the Dentist Podcast.